Today we are in Judges 17 and 18. If you want to turn your Bibles to there, if you have your little study guides, you can grab those as well. The hopelessness and helplessness of idolatry. That's kind of the title I gave today's message. I don't know about you, but I love Christmas songs, particularly because I save them till after Thanksgiving. That's right. Boom. They just sound better. There's nothing more delicious than a short period of time to enjoy something. If you can eat the Thanksgiving meal every single day of your life, it won't taste as good unless you eat it one day of the year. It's just the way things work, right? If you have coffee every single morning, it's just as good. So that breaks down. But anyway, let me grab my notes here. I was really amazed by this chapter, or these two chapters, so I was excited to recover, or at least pretend like I recovered, and come here and teach on these things. So Proverbs. Judges 17. We've been in Judges all fall long, and I hope you guys have enjoyed kind of doing what feels like a pretty fast cruise through Judges, but I hope you've also enjoyed the opportunity to get into the Bible on your own as well. I hope you've been challenged by that, encouraged. We're going to do something a little bit different, though. As I was looking through the questions this week, I was struggling with how to kind of explain what's going on and smashing it into these question forms. So if you've read Judges 17 and 18 this last week, great job, good work. But I'm going to kind of just work through the story, just a little bit reading it, and then just work through it. And then at the very end, we're going to talk about the second half of the study guide. So that's where the questions are going to come in. So we're going to kind of skip the first. Now, if you really have great answers for the first part, You can listen really closely and see if you kind of hear your answers in kind of what I say. If you're starting to track with Judges the way I am, so let's just start in Judges 17. We're probably at a point where we're beginning to think, man, we just got through Samson, like the mirror of all of us, and we're starting to think it can't get any worse than this, right? How much worse can you get than someone like Samson? We were talking about this last week, right? It's like, is this guy a good guy or a bad guy? Is this guy gonna? I mean, is this guy like a millennial kingdom kind of guy? Where is Samson gonna show up? It can't be. Thank you very much. Can't get any worse than this. Well, I have news for you. It gets worse. It gets much, much worse. And there we go. I'm going to quickly give you a review of the book of Judges. Bam. All right. Wait, let's go back there. All right. Okay, so let's start off with, let's read the first part of Judges 17, 1 through 6 together. Now, there was a hill, now there was a man. I mean, I know I normally do this, but my mind feels like there's a bag of cement in it. So I feel like it's more obvious. Now, there was a man of the hill country of Ephraim whose name was Micah. He said to his mother, the 1,100 pieces of silver, which were taken from you, about which you uttered a curse and spoke of it in my hearing, behold, the silver is with me. It was I who took it. And his mother said, blessed be my son by Yahweh. And he then returned the 1,100 pieces of silver to his mother. And his mother said, I wholly set apart the silver from my hand as holy to Yahweh for my son to make a graven image and a molten image. So now I will return them to you. So he returned the silver to his mother, and his mother took 200 pieces of silver and gave them to the silversmith, and he made them into a graven image and a molten image, and they were in the house of Micah. And the man Micah had a shrine, and he made an ephod and the household idols, and ordained one of his sons, and he became his priest. In those days there was no king in Israel. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. If you're a underlining type, that's kind of a key verse. in the book of Judges there. But let's just stop here and let's ask a question. We're going to ask five questions as we read through our passage, and then we'll hopefully get to those other questions in your booklet. First question, why would anybody want a shrine, idol, molten image in their house? Why would anybody want a shrine in their own house? Answer, it provides blessing and security, right? You got that? Blessing and security, especially in an insecure time like the period of Judges. Are you getting a sense for the period of the Judges? Like if I just happen to teach on a certain book of the Bible for winter retreat, and the first verse in that book was as follows. It was the time when the judges judged. You'd kind of get a sense like, well, this was a dicey time. It was a time when everybody was doing what was right in their own eyes. It was a time when if you didn't have your own sword, your own army, everything you had could be taken from you. It was a time of exceptional insecurity. So having an idol, a shrine in your house, which is like a place where an idol is worshipped, having that in your house provided a sense of security and blessing. Do you understand that? Such a family shrine would be a prized heirloom. Actually, this one is literally made out of the family kind of wallet here. This is a lot of money. By the way, 1,100 pieces of silver is a lot of money. This is a small fortune, enough to turn the heads of several people in our story, as you will see. We know, of course, Delilah got five times this amount, but that just shows you how much Delilah was getting, because this in and of itself was a small fortune. Notice, his mother expresses a curse on the person who took it. And the son said, I took it. Then she said, oh, backtrack. I'm going to give it to you. Blessed are you, my son. And maybe if I bless you, you won't be cursed. We'll see how that works out for him. This was a lot of money. But such gods weren't like massive gods, okay? So we're not thinking like in the back of Micah and his mom's house, we have this massive statue, this massive golden pillar. Like, that's not the picture you should have. Probably these were smaller idols, like travel size, for your convenience, you know? We know that because, anybody remember the story of Genesis 31? Jacob has those two wives, Rachel and Leah, and they decide to run away from their father Laban because he's just a trickster, just like Jacob. Sometimes you meet people just like you, okay? And Laban follows, and he's fuming. He says he's fuming because Jacob has taken away his two daughters and their children, but he doesn't really care about his daughters. That's pretty clear. What he's really concerned about is, and you've taken my idols. Like he's willing to chase down Jacob to track down his family idols. These were valuable things, but they were also travel size, right? You could sit on them. That was kind of a joke with the Israelite population. But so these could be a very small thing or big thing, but probably smaller. We see both the mother and the son seem like equally corrupt. I mean, I don't know if you noticed, but it's kind of hard to see Micah as a good character in all of this. Also, his mother, I don't know, it's just curious to me. She wholly sets apart the silver and the gold for Micah, but then she only gives him sixth percentage of it. So it's like, I don't know, maybe it's not the greatest generosity statement either. But I would say the big thing here is these two people are kind of a microcosm or a portrait or a picture of the entire generation of people around them, okay? So this is Israel. Once again, we see in Samson, we see he's kind of like a picture of everybody. And in these two people, he's a picture, they're pictures of everybody. They're doing what is right in their own eyes, just like Israel is doing what is right in their own eyes. Now, you see that verse? I told you it was important. Verse 6, every man did what was right in his own eyes. Now you get a sense that that's a bad thing. You're like, that doesn't sound good. But I mean, there's kind of a side of an American inside of you maybe that thinks like, is that so bad? I mean, free liberty. If I like coffee in the morning, I can have coffee in the morning. I'm going to do what is right in my own eyes. Well, this, I think, is intentionally worded this way, and I could make an argument even from the Hebrew that it's trying to quote a verse from Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is a book written by Moses that's giving all of these rules and commands about how the people are to live, both in the wilderness and in the promised land when they get there. And it's very curious that this verse sounds a lot like something that Moses said to the children of Israel in the wilderness. Of course, he's saying this when they're in the wilderness, and he's looking forward to the land. But if you were to look up Deuteronomy 12, verse 8, you'd see this: "You shall not do all that we are doing here today. Every man doing what is right in his own eyes." Catch that? Right? It's word for word almost, right? You shouldn't do what we're doing here, right? Moses is saying you're going into a land, a prosperous land, a blessed land, and you should have, first off, this is what he's going to say in Deuteronomy, one place of worship. You should hear my law. You should obey my law. You shouldn't do what is right in your own eyes. You should seek to do what is right in my eyes. That is Deuteronomy. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind, right? If you don't do this, you will experience curses. We haven't seen any curses, though, in Judges yet, right? No curses. Oh, yes, we've seen a lot of curses, haven't we? We've seen famine. We've seen all sorts of things like that, natural curses. But we've also seen the other kind of curses that Moses himself was predicting in Deuteronomy 28. We've seen armies invading. We've seen people turning on each other. We've seen all of the things that Moses predicted in this, because people were living in a very anti-biblical way. They were doing what was right in their own eyes. So you'd build a shrine in your house to make yourself feel safe, because God wasn't safety for you. But let's keep reading. Verse 7. Whoa, there's a lot of reading today. And there was a young man from Bethlehem in Judah, of the family of Judah, who was a Levite. And he was sojourning there. Then the man went from the city, from Bethlehem in Judah, to sojourn wherever he might find a place. And as he made his journey, he came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah. And Micah said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I am a Levite from Bethlehem in Judah, and I am going to sojourn wherever I may find a place." Micah said to him, "Remain with me and be a father and a priest to me, and I will give you 10 pieces of silver a year, a suit of clothes, and your sustenance." So the Levite went in. And the Levite was willing to remain with the man, and the young man became to him like one of his sons. This Levite was a young man, by the way. So verse 12, Micah ordained a Levite, and the young man became his priest and lived in the house of Micah. Then Micah said, "Now I know that Yahweh will prosper me because I have a Levite as a priest." Now, this proposes our second question. Why would somebody want a Levite as a priest for their Yahweh-rejecting homemade shrine? Why would somebody want a Levite as a priest for their shrine? Any ideas? Yes. Cover all the bases. I get what you're saying. Any other ideas? Yes?
So that just as like a last-day checkers, like if your idol isn't working out, you can go to God.
Yeah, we've got a Levite priest, right? If the idol doesn't work, maybe the Levite will. Yes?
If the Levite serves the idol, then maybe Yahweh will protect the Levite and bless the idol.
Yeah. Yeah, a little bit more secure. I mean, you see it. You see it there in verse 13, right? This is why you'd want a Levite as a priest. "Now I know that Yahweh will prosper me because I have a Levite as priest." Here, you're doing what is right in your own eyes, and you're also ignoring the word of God and just kind of making up your own religion, and you're basically saying, "Hey, all we need is a Levite as priest, and we're good. Prosperity and blessing." Just like the same reason you'd want a shrine in your bedroom, right? Prosperity and blessing. Why do I want a Levite? I want prosperity and blessing. A Levite, especially one like this Levite, but more on that later, will ensure blessing and security. And it will also give your shrine a semblance, you could say, of legitimacy, right? This is a Levitical shrine. This isn't a Canaanite shrine. This is a Levite-like shrine. We notice that Micah seems to know he's missing something. In verse 5 of chapter 17, he ordains his own son, to become a priest, but that's not a Levite. And that's not a son of Aaron, right? And so there's a sense in which this isn't an Israelite shrine, but they're trying to make it a little bit more orthodox here. And now there's this thought that Yahweh, notice the word Yahweh, will bless me because I have a Levite as priest. Now, let's move on a little bit. In verse 18, you could kind of intro chapter 18 like this. Meanwhile, in another part of the world that's completely unrelated to our story, I'm sure, we have the tribe of Dan, who is still unsatisfied with their, shopping for land. They're still trying to figure out where their land inheritance will fall. We're going to read chapter 18, 1 through 6, but actually, I'm going to have one of you read it because my mind feels like spaghetti. So, I'm not sick, though. I'm not sick. I have no flu-like symptoms. So, Emma, could you read for us 1 through 6?
In those days, there was no king of Israel, and in those days, the tribe of the Danites was seeking an inheritance for themselves to live in. For until that day, the land among the tribes of Israel had not fallen to them as an inheritance. So the sons of Dan sent from their family 5 men out of their whole number, men of valor, from Zorah and Eshtol.
Close enough.
Okay. To spy out the land and to search it. And they said to them, "Go, search the land." And they came to the hill country of Ephraim, to the house of Micah, and lodged there. They were near the house of Micah, and they recognized the voice of the young man, the Levite. So they turned aside there and said to him, "Who brought you here, and what are you doing in this place, and what do you have here?" And he said to them, "Thus and so has Micah done to me, and he has hired me, and I have become..." And they said to him, "Ask of God, please, that we may know whether our way on which we are going will be successful." So the priest said to them, "Go in peace. Your way in which you are going is before Yahweh."
All right. Okay, another question for you. Why would the Danites be interested in a priest's opinion for their land quest? I bet you know the answer. I bet you know the answer. Josias, what's the answer? What's the answer? Blessing and security. All right, I think you guys are picking up on the theme. Are you picking up on the theme? This is actually really easy. Well, look at this. A priest, especially a priest of this caliber, more on that later, a priest like this all but guarantees a favorable response from God. Remember Balaam, Numbers 25, Numbers 22. Remember Balaam, the king of Moab went to go get Balaam, because a priest, a prophet of that caliber, all but guaranteed a favorable cursing on the children of Israel. And that's why these guys are interested in this priest. Like, if we ask of God by him, God will bless our way. It's not necessarily that they're saying, "Hey, can you predict for us how it will go?" But it's almost like, "Hey, can you bless us so that we will be ensured a favorable outcome?" Notice in verse 5, they say, "Ask of God." We're not really sure what God they're talking about, but the Levite seems to speak freely, assumes the name of Yahweh, and that is something that's very encouraging to them. But this is interesting. I don't know if you noticed this. verse 3, his voice, do you notice this, is recognizable to them. Like, like they're walking down the street, and they hear him in the backyard with the shrine. That's how I picture this. And they're like, "Hey, I know that voice. Wait, he's got a different accent than everybody else. Maybe that's how it was." Or maybe they actually recognized his voice because they knew him because he was maybe famous. But more on that later. And then notice also, then they begin to ask him all these questions. Did you see that? "Who brought you here? What are you doing in this place? Why is a priest like you in a shrine like this?" It's also how guys try to ask a girl out. What's a cute... Never mind. So there we go. So all to say, they would want the priest's opinion because it brought a favorable outcome. And their way does, in fact, seem blessed. Let's read chapter 18, 7 through 13. Let's go with Brooklyn, can you read for us? 18:7-13.
Then the five men went forth and came to Laish and saw the people who were in it living in security, after the manner of the Sidonians, quiet and secure, for there was no oppressive conqueror dishonoring them for anything in the land, and they were far from the Sidonians and had no dealings with anyone. So they came back to their brothers at Zorah and Eshtol, and their brothers said to them, "What do you report?" And they said, "Arise and let us go up against them, for we have seen the land, and behold, it is very good. And will you be silent? Do not delay to go to enter to possess the land. When you enter, you will come to a secure people and a spacious land, for God has given it into your hand, and a place where there is no lack of anything that is offered." Then from the family of the Danites, from Zorah and from Eshtol, 600 men armed with weapons of war set out, and they were up and camped at Kirith.
Good luck. Just skip that. Just keep moving.
In Judah. Therefore, they called that place something to this day. It was Kiriath Jearim. Then they passed from there to the hill country of Ephraim and came to the house of Micah.
I don't know if you remember, but like some of these names that we're reading were names that we were reading a lot of during our trek through Samson's story. So actually, Mahanadan to this day means the camp of Dan. So this it was like a place where a lot of Danites actually chose to stay. They didn't actually choose to go up north with the rest of the tribe of Dan. And then Zorah and Eshtoal. That's also a place where Samson grew up. So, like this is Samson territory we're talking about here. But those names are no joke, not fun to read, especially out loud in public after being given 1 minute of notice. But this brings us. Oh, you've got a question already.
Kiriath Jearim, was that the Gibeonite city, Joshua 9?
I thought it was in Lord of the Rings. Joshua 9,
where the Gibeonites had the wealthy cities that they came from, and Israel was mad because they didn't get to take the city.
Oh, maybe. I can't remember off the top of my head, but look it up. Yes?
Just kind of going back to chapter 17, but how would you put 1,100 pieces of silver in today's money?
That's a little bit of a backtrack there, but we'll go with it. I would say I thought I read something like 140 pounds. Sounds like a lot of money. Silver, you know. I mean, if it's sand, it's not a lot of money, but if it's silver, it's a lot of money. But that's 1,100 pieces of silver. People aren't really totally sure what that means. They just say it's 100 pieces of silver. Yes. That's a question I could have asked because everybody was doing what was right in their own eyes, right? That's the only explanation. And I guess that's why that's why the day two question is, have you ever read a story or watched a movie where you can't figure out who the bad guy is or the good guy is? How can you tell who's who? By the hints that the story gives you. And the only hints they give you, the only time the narrator speaks, is there in verse 6 and then in 18, verse 1. Everybody's doing what is right in their own eyes. That's the only conclusion. This guy did this because it seemed right to him in the moment. That's why he did it. Yes. We're never going to get done. All right. Let's go. Let's go.
Is this where the prosperity gospel comes from?
I don't think so, because the prosperity gospel would say God will bless you if you do these right things. If you do these things, you can count on God. Or if you call on God to bless you, then maybe he'll bless you then. But maybe there's a correlation. Maybe that's something else. Yeah. All I'd say is I wouldn't root the history of the prosperity movement in this chapter. That's all I would say. I would say there's definite tendencies in humanity to seek prosperity from God. And you see that all throughout the Bible even, so you see that play out in church history too. But people always want blessings from God if it's easy to get, right? All right, any other questions? Can I ask my question now? All right, now that we've read chapter 18:7-13, you're probably asking this question. You're not actually worried about any of those questions. Those are like, hey, David, just so I asked it. But the question you're really wondering, no, you're not. You're not wondering, maybe. But I think it's important to ask, why would Dan need new or need to find their land allotment? And if you remember the book of Joshua, like 10 chapters. It's actually pretty difficult reading. 10 chapters of the book of Joshua go into painful detail about where the boundary lines are for everything. If you don't like reading this chapter because it has three names that are hard to read, I dare you. Go to Joshua chapter whatever it is and just read and just have fun. Read out loud, read to your family, just today. You know, it'll be real fun. Like, see how much you can cover. but they're like describing the land with boulder references. You go over to the boulder, then you turn left, then you go up to the spring. Like, everybody knew exactly where their land was. And yes, in Joshua 19:40-48, the Danites received a land allotment. Now, it wasn't big. It was tucked away, you know, in between Ephraim and Judah and Benjamin's on their right, if you're looking at them from above. And so it kind of seems small and cramped. And of course, they got the Amorite problem and they got the Philistine problem. But man, they were small. They were small. But why would Dan need a new land allotment? Any guesses? Yes?
Because they didn't already settle it. The people who heard the instructions died off, and so they have to find it again.
Okay. Yes?
For peace and security.
For peace and security. You got it. You got it. Or to say it this way, same answer. They weren't content with the land that God had given them. They were going north. They were going north, outside of the land almost, right below Mount Hermon, right above the Sea of Galilee. They didn't want the land that God had given them. They were discontent. It was too hard for them. It was too difficult. They couldn't subdue the land, and instead of seeking Yahweh's help to achieve the calling to which they had been called, they gave up. And they said, we're going to seek an easier way to find peace and prosperity. You got that? You got that theme right there? Every time I'm talking about prosperity, I'm talking to you. Every time I'm talking about name usage, I'm talking to you. You know, like, I got my points. All right. Every time I'm talking about healthcare, I'm talking over there. All right. So, all right. They weren't content, and they weren't willing to ask the Lord. They weren't willing to seek the Lord's strength. They weren't willing to humble themselves and pray and repent. Instead, they were going to pursue their own desires. And so, they head up to this place called Laish. I picture Laish as... you know, on the outside of like small towns, if you drive into them, at least this is the way it is in the Midwest, there's like these signs with the population, you know, on the outside. And then also there's like a slogan for the city, Wadena, Minnesota, where the prairie meets the woodlands. That's where I grew up, right? All that's saying is it's just a lot of farmland and nobody wants to be here for vacation. That's all that's really actually saying. There's no lakes here. It's just the prairie meeting the woodlands. Nobody cares. But there's like slogans. And no city ever like has a bad slogan. Like Chicago never says, welcome to Chicago. Keep your doors locked. I don't think that is a slogan. But I picture Laish's slogan as this. The Danites post this up first thing when they arrive, right? Laish, welcome to Laish. Everything our original inheritance was not. The great place that God could not give us, right? They were squashed into this little postage stamp of land down below. But now up here in the north, they had lots of security and freedom. Oh, down below they were smashed between two ginormous greedy tribes, Judah and Ephraim. And they also had the Philistines and the Amorites to worry about. But up here, they got lots of space, lots of room, lots of land, and it was valuable land too. From the entire history of Israel, you always see Dan, this site, being occupied. There was a hill, and it was surrounded by this prosperous farmland because the water flowed right down from Mount Hermon, and it was beautiful. And there was even like fortifications that were built there as well. It was far, in other words, from any apparent danger. It was far from danger. It was easy. It was a good land. By the way, just a little location note here. This was not a part of the original land allotment. I'm trying to think about what this means, but it seems to me that the Laishites, if that's how you would say them, were not the cursed Canaanites that perhaps the Amorites would have been. They were one of those nations you could consider like far from you, which you would go to battle against, and you'd offer terms of peace, and if they refused to give you terms of peace, then you could go in and crush them and kill off all their men. But then you wouldn't, of course, destroy their city or their women or their children. You wouldn't do that. But notice the Nanites just blow the whole thing up. So it doesn't really seem like they're actually doing the conquest. Instead of performing the conquest for the places that they've been given to conquest, they are going outside the land and kind of breaking God's law to do that. And there's a big irony here, too. Here's the big irony. Are you ready for this? If you could, let's say, if you could read the future, and you all can because you can turn over to, say, 1st, 2nd Kings, where do all of the enemies come from? Do they come from the south? Maybe Egypt once or twice, Josiah. But where do the enemies come from?
North,
right? Assyria, everybody, even if you're over here, you have to go up here because there's a desert right there. So you have to, I'm back around for you. Everybody came from the north. If you're coming from Babylon, you came from the north. If you came from Damascus, you were from the north. If you're coming from Assyria, you came from the north. If you came from Syria, you came from the north. Everybody was coming from the north. If you're a Greek, you're coming from the north. You know, everybody's coming from the north. That means, actually, if you think about it, Dan forsook the safety of Judah. Who lasted the longest? The tribe of Judah. Who was toast first? The northernmost tribes. So there's a little bit of irony there for you. But anyway, safety and security is always the name of the game. Let's read our fifth reading. Here we go. Can we do it in time? All right, Addie Board, can you take us to the promised land? I'm out of breath. I need to breathe for a little while. 14 through 31. Can you do it? All right, go for it.
There are in the houses an ephod and a household idols and a graven image and a molten image. So now, know what you should do. Then they turned aside there and came to the house of the young man, the Levite, to the house of Micah, and asked him of his welfare. Now the 600 men, armed with their weapons of war, who were the sons of Dan, were standing by the entrance of the gate. Then the 5 men who went to spy out the land went up and entered there, and took the graven image, and the ephod, and the household idols, and the molten image. And the priest was standing by the entrance of the gate with the 600 armed men with the weapons of war. Now these had entered into Micah's house, and took the graven image, and the ephod, and the household idols, and the molten image. Then the priest said to them, "What are you doing?" And they said to him, "Be silent, put your hand over your mouth, and come with us, and be to us a father and a priest. Is it better for you to be a priest to the house of one man, or to be priest to a tribe and a family in Israel?" And the priest's heart was merry, and he took the ephod and household idols and the graven image and entered among the people. Then they turned away and went and put the little ones and the livestock and the valuables in front of them. They had gone some distance from the house of Micah, and the men who were in the houses near Micah's house were summoned and then overtook the sons of Dan. And they called out to the sons of Dan, who turned around and said to Micah, "What is the matter with you that you were summoned together?" And he said, "You have taken away my gods which I made, and the priests, and have gone away, and what do I have besides? So how can you say to me, 'What is the matter with you?'" Then the sons of Dan said to him, "Do not let your voice be heard among us, lest men, bitter of soul, fall upon you, and you lose your life with the lives of your household." So the sons of Dan went on their way, and when Micah saw that they were too strong for him, he turned and went back to his house. Now they took what Micah had made, and the priests who had belonged to him, and they came to Laish, to a people quiet and secure, and struck them with the edge of the sword, and they burned the city with fire. And there was no one to deliver them, because it was far from Sidon, and they had no dealings with anyone, and it was in the valley which is near Beth Rehob. And they built the city and lived in it. And they called the name of the city Dan, after the name of Dan their father, who was born in Israel. However, the name of the city was formerly was Laish. Then the sons of Dan set up for themselves the graven image, and Jonathan, the son of Jeshoam, the son of Moses, he and his sons were priests to the tribe of the Danites until the day of exile of the land. So they set up for themselves Micah's graven image, which he had made, all the time that the house of God was at Shiloh.
All right. I don't know if any of you are with me, but in verse 28, when she read, they built this city, she started singing in the back of your head. Anyway, all right. This brings up another important question, though, all song aside. Why would somebody want to steal a shrine and a Levite? Mateo? What? Blessing and prosperity, and because why? Peace and security, and because they did what was right. They what? A very famous Levite. Yes, this would provide assurance of prosperity through legitimacy. Right, legitimacy. See, we're supposed to be here. We've got a Levite, and not just any Levite. Look at the Levite we've got. We're supposed to be up here in the north, in this totally secure place, in this prosperous place. We're supposed to be here. We've got ourselves a Levite. They already saw how powerful and important such a Levite could be. He had already predicted their way and was totally right. He was a great source of blessing both for Micah in Micah's eyes and for the Danites as well. He was an important person. But I want you guys to also notice the complete, and I find this to be ironic, the complete helplessness in this chapter of Micah himself. Did you notice how helpless Micah is against the thugs? And here's where we're starting to laugh a little bit. Verse 24, you have taken away my gods, which I have made, and the priest, and have gone away. And what do I have besides? We feel a little sad for the guy, right? He just lost his entire family fortune, perhaps. But also, they took away his God that he had made. Everything that he had pinned his hope on, actually. And remember, chapter 17, verse 13. Now Yahweh will prosper. I've got nothing now because I don't have this shrine and I don't have this Levite. You've taken it all away. Kind of sounds a lot like Joash, Gideon's father, though. Remember, when everybody's getting mad at Gideon, he knocked down the idol of Baal. He needs to die. And Joash is like, have you ever thought that maybe Baal should defend himself? If we've got to defend Baal, I feel like we've got things turned around, right? And that's just the irony of this picture, right? He's left penniless and he's left priestless, but this is his helplessness. This was his actual helplessness with this idol. He thought he had prosperity. He thought he had blessing, but really he had nothing, and it was exposed in this moment, right? Same thing goes with a lot of characters in this story, but that is the key, right? You thought you had everything. You thought you had security. You thought if you went over here, you'd be safe, but you weren't. Turns out you were defeated. Notice the Danites, they're kind of confused back in chapter 18. Chapter 18, remember those questions they were asking? Who brought you here, verse 3? And what are you doing in this place? How did you end up? What's a Levite like you ending up in a shrine like this? Now, how they should have answered that question is according to the Deuteronomy law. Chapter 12 of Deuteronomy says, if a prophet comes to you and starts saying, hey, let's serve other gods. If even your mother or your brother comes up to you and says, hey, let's start serving other gods. If one of the cities by you says, hey, we're serving other gods. You know what you're supposed to do with that prophet, mother, or city? You're supposed to stone them with stones and burn the city down. Right? That's what Dan should have done, but instead of that, they take the image for themselves. Once again, everybody's doing what is right in their own eyes, not what is right in God's eyes, are they? No, not at all. Deuteronomy 13, that's where this is from. Deuteronomy 13, 10 says it very graphically. So you shall stone him to death because he has sought to drive you from Yahweh your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Thus all Israel will hear and be afraid and will never again do such an evil thing among you. That's what Dan should have done, but instead they take the idols. Now, this, of course, leads us to your homework. There we go. Plenty of time. I just thought I needed to give you a little bit of, like, background context so we could have a very profitable conversation in 1 minute. So here we go. Question one. By question one, I mean question three. Judges, I'm sorry about the typo here. Judges 27 through 28 comes off as a little unexpected. Why do we think the narrator focuses our gaze on helpless Cainites, or whoever they were, at this point in the story? So remember, 27 and 28 speaks of these people from Laish as helpless, right? No one to deliver them. They had no dealings with anyone. They were helpless. Why suddenly are we talking about this? We've been talking all Judges long about the sinfulness of Israel, and why are the Danites being blessed here like that? Yes.
It shows their sin against Deuteronomy 20, where it says you offered peace and then you attack them, where you don't just go in and kill them all.
Sure. Yeah. So they were breaking the law. Perhaps that's what we see. Yeah. I think that's true. I think it also shows that Laish was a bit proud, too, right? We've got this secure place. Nobody's ever going to come and take us out here. But I also think that the people of Laish are meant to remind us of someone. They're meant to remind us of characters in this very story. How can the Danites, with stolen gods in a rebellious land grab, experience such success? But these Laishes remind us of Micah. Remember, who is supposed to remind us of someone else, right? They seem so secure, but really they are helpless. Really, this is Israel, right? Following their false gods. Israel, look at yourself. You are no better than this group of people that has no God. You are helpless and without any deliverer. That's who you are when you serve idols. And ironically, that's who Micah is in this story, and that's who the Danites will be with their idols and their shrine that they're bringing up there. They're going to be the first ones to be invaded every single time, right? Let's move on to the next question really quick. Judges, this is perhaps the most interesting portion of the entire book, if you ask me. I can't believe this part. Judges 18:30. Did you notice that the narrator doesn't tell us the priest's name until the very end of the story? Who is this priest and what's the significance of his presence to the spiritual situation of Israel? Did you guys think about this? I mean, what's the big name there? Any big names? Yes, Christian?
His name was Jonathan.
His name was Jonathan?
He's
the grandson of Moses. So, once again, famous, right? I recognize your voice. You sound a lot like your grandfather, maybe. But also, think about how short of a period of time this was. This means he was a contemporary. You know what that word means? It means you kind of like live in the same time as the great-grandson of Aaron, who is Phinehas, who was the priest when Israel entered the land during the conquest. So this is early on in the book of Judges, actually, in like timeline, chronology. Like, this is actually early on. This isn't the end of the period of the Judges when everybody's just destroying themselves, right? This is really relatively soon in the timeline of Israel. And that tells you something very important, right? You can disregard God and his word, and it will not take long for your whole world and your life to go topsy-turvy and sin to spiral you down to the basement. That's what it tells you, right? It doesn't take long. It doesn't take centuries for sin to do its effect on your life. It doesn't even take decades. It can take months. It can take days. It can take hours, you know? And that should cause us to be fearful. Don't think that breathtaking, heartbreaking, life-destroying moral compromise is something far from you. It can be very close to you based on what you're willing to compromise. The Israelites, we see how quick they started to compromise. Notice, the very grandson of Moses compromises everything he learned growing up. And this is the destruction that he was left with. But this leaves us with our final question, and this kind of brings up the title that I gave to this study guide. What does this chapter have to teach us about helplessness and hopelessness? What does it have to teach us about helplessness and hopelessness? Yes.
There's no peace or security in anything other than God.
Yeah, right. What do you say?
How the
idols are, they're trying to fill the hole that only God can fill.
Mm-hmm.
Like the one ring where someone takes it and they say, oh, now I'm keeping it. I'm not going to destroy it. Oh, no, I'm stealing from you. Oh, wait, no, hang on. I don't want to destroy it. I want to keep it myself.
Right, right.
And how
they tend to destroy you.
Once you get into it, you're kind of stuck there.
Yeah.
It's like a glue trap where you get one hand stuck.
Uh-huh.
You free it with the other hand, and then the other hand's stuck,
yeah. It's a good illustration. Idols tend to do that, right? Yeah. Helplessness and hopelessness. We are looking at this whole two chapters and just portrait after portrait, and every single one, I hope you see this, is just a portrait and a picture, a microcosm of the helplessness and hopelessness in Israel, right? And this is everybody doing what is right in their own eyes, not directing their lives, not taking God's word seriously in their everyday life, but just living as they think is right. And this leads to a tangible helplessness and hopelessness. And notice it begins in the decisions you make. It says, hey, we can't get this land. I mean, who cares if God promises it to us? We can't get it. We're going to give up. We're going to give up, right? Helplessness and hopelessness. It begins in your mind. It begins in your decisions. We see Laish is helpless and hopeless. We see Micah is helpless and hopeless. We see Dan. We see all Israel is like this as well. And that is a picture of Israel. This is the spiritual situation in Israel. So these final chapters in Judges kind of are an epilogue, which is kind of like an end note to the whole book. It kind of ended with Samson. But now the author is going to tell us something about the spiritual condition and then the political condition. And next week we're going to talk about more of the moral political condition. But right now we're just looking at the religious spiritual condition. This is where their mind is. Of course they're going to do what they're doing. Because they're serving themselves. They're not serving God in their minds and their hearts, and they're not seeking to obey his word. Let's pray. Dear God in heaven, thank you for this time that we've been given. Pray that you would bless us through your word even this next week as we look into how absolute destruction a sin can produce in our lives if it is unfought, if it is surrendered to, if we give in to it, if we allow ourselves to compromise with it. We see what a disaster it does to our thinking, to our value system. And we pray even that you would help us through this chapter to hate our sin even more, and even this day to fight against sin in a new and a fresh way, and to serve you with our mind and our heart and all of our being. Amen.